Mark Zuckerberg is probably kind of a template for what we picture when we think of entrepreneurs, especially the techie kind of entrepreneurs. In The Social Network, the movie about the crazy beginnings of Facebook, he's the quintessential young guy in a hoodie, smugly outsmarting his elders who dress in suits and think they know better, but...
I don't understand.
Which part?
You deserve recognition.
I believe I pointed out some pretty gaping holes in your system.
Excuse me, may I?
Yes.
Mr. Zuckerberg, I'm in charge of security for all computers on the Harvard network, and I can assure you of its sophistication. In fact, it was that level of sophistication that led us to you in less than 4 hours.
4 hours?
Yes, sir.
That would be impressive, except if you had known what you were looking for, you would have seen it written on my dorm room window.
Okay, so that is a kind of entrepreneur, but it's not the only kind. In fact, in 2016, people between the ages of 55 and 64 accounted for more than 25% of new entrepreneurs, a percentage that appears to be on the rise. That statistic is cited in a new book called Purpose and a Paycheck, which is all about this under-recognized trend of boomers and their startups. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And the author of that book is with us now. Chris Farrell, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. That statistic I just cited is actually from a study done here in Kansas City at the Kauffman Foundation. Why is the stat significant enough to you that you put it in the intro to your book?
So there is a grassroots movement rethinking, reimagining the second half of life. And a big part of this rethinking involves working longer, well into the traditional retirement years. And so I've done a lot of work and research looking at phased retirement, part-time retirement, you know, flexible jobs. But in doing my research, I kept coming up with people who were doing entrepreneurship and self-employment. And this Kauffman Foundation statistic that you cited is really compelling. And so I think one of the big surprises that everyone is starting to grasp is that as you get older, as you're in that second half of life, entrepreneurship may be a very smart way to stay employed, to stay engaged, to make some money and income, and to do something that you feel good about that gives you purpose.
You know, I mean, I want to just something you said, a chance to make some money, some income. One of the things that you always hear about entrepreneurship is that, you know, like fail fast or, you know, like that you, it is a risky venture. And so there is some logic to the idea that you would take these risks earlier in life and not want to, you know, possibly also lose all your money as you're entering retirement.
So what most people are doing, we're not talking about taking your 401k or your 403b and, you know, draining it out and, you know, I got this great product, I got this great service, and I think it's going to pay off. No, that's not what's going on here. And by the way, if you're listening to this broadcast, don't do it. Don't touch your retirement savings. Typically what we're talking about is a lot of these businesses are called lifestyle businesses. Your home is the office, or you join a co-sharing workspace. You're doing a lot of work over the internet, a lot of experimenting. You're building off your connections that you developed over the years. And so the typical business is starting with $5,000 or less. You know, that's the kind of entrepreneurship that I'm talking about.
But like just staying with this idea of like, maybe what people tend to imagine when they think of who are like the entrepreneurs and the startup people, like the stat we came across, people in their 50s and 60s are starting new businesses at twice the rate of people in their 20s.
Yes, and there's a couple of reasons that are behind that. If you think about what is entrepreneurship, you're solving a problem. You have an idea. You have a product, you have a service, you're going to solve the customer's problem. And a lot of times that takes experience, knowledge, skill to figure out, well, what is the problem and how can I solve it? So I actually don't think it's that surprising. It's just that we have such a youth culture and such a focus on youth culture, and Silicon Valley has sort of dominated the image of what is the entrepreneur in modern day America. But if you go all around, you know, Kansas City, Twin Cities, where I'm based, there's all kinds of people who have had decent careers or they've learned something and they get to their 50s or 60s or 70s and are saying, I got a product, I have a service, I can solve a problem, and they start a business. And actually that is what is so much is going on, that experience really matters when you are an entrepreneur.
You know, I mean, you've done a little bit of this already, but we hear so much about what makes the traditional, like, work for someone else scenario inhospitable enough to young people in the current economy, that the risk of entrepreneurship is just worth it for them in a way that maybe it hasn't been for younger generations. But you kind of make your own case for the traditional workplace being just as inhospitable to older workers.
Age discrimination is real. And there's just no doubt. And how many people have been in a meeting or sat in a room and someone's sitting there and going, oh, I can't remember. Oh, her name, his name. Oh, I'm having a senior moment. Now, people don't even think about saying something like this. And if there's a high-tech problem, a lot of times, you don't turn to your experienced workers. You know, we need to get a younger person. Age discrimination is really real. And so one of the things that I find with the entrepreneurship is that the people who are starting companies in the second half of life, starting organizations, starting social enterprises, they're not going to wait for society to change. You're not going to wait for management to wake up. They're going to go out and they're creative, they're innovative, they're productive, they have an idea, they can still contribute to the society. So why wait for the human resources department to finally realize that experience is really important? And by the way, we should be focused on retaining these experienced workers, not encouraging them to retire. Entrepreneurs are saying they're some of the best workers in any organization, and they're the ones that aren't sitting around waiting.
You know, it's interesting because you hear this other argument. I mean, you hear a very similar argument being made on behalf of the young worker, that age discrimination is real, that I'm not going to sit around and wait. And also that, like, the flip side of the experience question is freshness of ideas and a willingness to try things that someone else who's been at it for a while might just say, tried that, didn't work. Well, So it seems like there's this, in a healthy idea about this, there could be some give and take where it's like, maybe both things are a little bit true.
Yes. And you've hit on something that's really important. When you look at the research, one of the things that comes out of it is multi-generational teams are your most productive teams. And many businesses, whether nonprofit, for-profit, you know, everyone's kind of embracing this sort of team framework. And it's a good framework, actually, to embrace. And again, if you're bringing experienced people and you're bringing young people in there. So part of this, and that I really want to stress, this is not anti-young people. And there's this Alan Glucksman. He's a professor at Temple University. He's been involved in aging for a long period of time. And one thing he said when I was at a conference that has just stuck with me, he says, look, the one thing that I have learned over the years, he's had a long career in this aging field. He goes, what is good for young people is good for older people. And what's good for older people is good for younger people. So this is not about the generations being against each other. This is about the advantages, the real advantages in organizations of multi-generational teams, of bringing experience in there. And, you know, in the other aspect of it, of as you mentioned, in terms of management, you know, companies, people being disillusioned when they're young, when they're older, you know, that kind of tells us that we've had a market for the past 20 years where there were plenty of workers out the door and managers didn't have to work that hard. Now we're in a tight labor market. All of a sudden, they're having to work with the generations. They're trying to retain their experienced workers. They're actually even starting to spend money on training and retraining their workers. So we've gone through a really difficult period of time where management was really in the driver's seat and the worker was being abused.
I'm curious what got you interested in all of this to begin with. Like, what is your personal drive to answer these questions about age and work?
So if you look at my career, which has had sort of two aspects, one is personal finance and the other is economics. And over the past 25 years in personal finance, the story has been about retirement savings or the lack of retirement savings. And when the boomers retire, you know, their standard of living is going to fall. In economics, a major factor is the demographics of aging, that with this aging population, that the underlying dynamism of the U.S. economy was going to crumble because we're going to have too many young people supporting too few young people supporting too many dependent elderly. And I was just suspicious about this. And so that got me interested in it. And I found all kinds of research that really fights against this sort of stereotypical article that with the aging of the population, that living standards are going to fall and the economy is going to weaken.
Why were you suspicious of it? It sounds very intuitive to me.
You know, it's partially that markets work, and it's partially I was sort of interested and have had an interest for a long time in sort of creativity and innovation. And you spend any time in that field of creativity and innovation, you begin to see that there's so many examples of people are actually doing their most creative work in their 60s, and then they're doing even more creative work in their 70s, and then they're even doing more creative work in their 80s. And we don't highlight these examples. And so that's, you know, you start looking at that, and then you start looking in the fields and the trades, and you begin to see that it's true. It's as people get more experienced, people become better at connecting the dots, and connecting the dots is one way that we have creativity, that we have wisdom. It was emphasized by Steve Jobs in his commencement speech that he gave, famous commencement speech at Stanford University. So we have all these examples, and so people still want to be contributing, and they can contribute. We just need to open the door for them to be able to be productive and creative, give them those opportunities, rather than saying, well, as you get older, yeah, you know, you get frail, you get elderly, you get stuck in your ways. And by the way, why don't you just leave?
Well, call 816-235-2888 to join this conversation about age and innovation. 816-235-2888 is the number to call with your story about how you think your age group fares in that entrepreneurial space. Chris Farrell, I am curious. I mean, I started the show talking about the stereotype of the entrepreneur and the tech startup persona. That stereotype comes from somewhere, right?
Yes, it does. And it comes from Silicon Valley. And there's a lot of venture capital money. And you just have there is a group of young people that were incredibly talented in the sort of consumer market. They really understood what teenagers and young people like. You think about Mark Zuckerberg with Facebook and building out of his college dorm room. And, you know, the same thing with Snap or Snapchat. I mean, there is a segment of the market where youth really does well. And you get these huge companies that grow very fast, and there's been a whole industry built around it. But when you look at other industries, in manufacturing, for example, there's a lot of entrepreneurship in manufacturing, but it tends to be people 50 plus are many of those entrepreneurs. And so as you look at different parts of the economy and go to different areas of the economy, you sort of see that, you know, it's partially industry dependent. And what Silicon Valley has really become, at least in the way that we think about it, it's really become the high-tech consumer products, entertainment products that are a lot of fun, targeted at young people, incredibly successful. But there's a lot of other areas in this economy where people are building companies.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we will hear from a guy who just started his startup at almost 70. And you, the number to call with your story is 816-235-2888. This is KCUR Central Standard. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we've been talking with the author of a new book called Purpose and a Paycheck. It's about the role that people 55 and older play in driving the economy by starting new businesses as entrepreneurs. Turns out that during the so-called sunset years, a lot of people are out there just getting started and doing it pretty competitively. My next guest is Bob Etzel. He has a new tech startup, and I'm a full generation younger than Bob, but I have to confess, I really don't get what his company does because the technology stuff that he's doing is over my head. Bob, good morning.
Well, good morning, Gina.
How old are you? Let's put it out there.
Well, I am 68.
And so what gave you the idea to start a tech venture, and when did the idea come to you?
I've really been involved in startups since 1990, and certainly involved in technologies. I was an executive at SBC, left there with an early out, and then started a training company that trained Bell Labs, Motorola, people like that, on advanced communications technology. So I've been involved in that for a long, long time.
Do you find that people are surprised to encounter someone your age in this sort of techie startup space, or is it less of an oddity than people might assume?
You know, I'm always so busy in what we're doing, I don't really watch the expression on people's faces if they're surprised or not. You know, we're so task-focused in what we're doing that frequently you don't really notice somebody's age. There's so much work to do and so much good to do that I don't think about it much. It does pop up from time to time, though.
How has age influenced your journey with this company?
I think a couple of ways. One is that I work with my wife, Megan Griggs, and so we've worked together for a long time. And a couple of things. One is that as a younger entrepreneur, we looked at riskier opportunities. It's kind of that basketball metaphor, taking the long shot. We don't take long shots anymore. We want that ball in the paint. I want something that if that's an opportunity we're going to work on, I can slam dunk that with my abilities and the network of people that I work with.
So it's a relationship with risk, but also kind of a payoff.
Definitely, you have to have the payoff there, whether it's the people that you're helping, your customer, payoff financially, but you're looking at that end game being shorter term and not longer term.
It's funny because there's such an embrace of this idea that like failure is a good thing in the sort of entrepreneurial world. Like, hey, you're going to learn from those failures. If you aren't putting yourself in a position where you could fail, you're not doing anything at all, that kind of idea. And that does not sound like the idea that you are functioning with as an older entrepreneur.
You know, you always hear that failure is a good thing, and you'll learn from that. But every day you fail, every day you stumble, and every day you pick yourself up. And so in the morning, you wonder what you're going to do. By the evening, hopefully you've solved that problem. You've gone on to something else. You have to have a lot of confidence in the other people on your team that they're really good and they know what they're doing.
Let's talk to Linda. Linda is calling us from Raytown, and she's kind of reiterating some of what we heard about how the workplace treats older workers and why working for yourself might have some particular appeal. Linda, good morning.
Good morning.
What's your
The thing that I've been listening to as you talk about this all are applicable to most people over 55, or at least those of us past 50. But the other strike that can be a barrier is that you're a minority. So when you're younger, you're a minority, but sometimes you can get past that hurdle a little pretty easily because you're fresh, you're young, you know, you're just getting in the workforce. When you become an older worker and you're a minority, that becomes something that's held against you. So I, too, have that entrepreneurial spirit. I, too, still have a lot to contribute and want to, but, you know, I face these barriers of going up against the millennial who's the HR person in some cases, who may have carried through life some preconceived ideas about a minority. So that just kind of complicates it when you're trying to remain viable in the workforce.
Yeah, Linda, I'm going to go ahead and let Chris Farrell respond to this. Chris Farrell's the author of Purpose in a Paycheck, and he's just written about all of this. Chris, is this something you hear a lot, I'm guessing?
It's something I hear a lot, and it's wrong. And it's terrible. Linda still has a lot to contribute. I think it's one of the reasons why so many people start a business. The one thing that can say with very clearly is that she will no longer be a minority, because in 2035, which is the forecast from the Census Bureau, that we will, for the first time in U.S. history, there will be more people 65 and older than 18 and under. And so there is a dramatic shift, and there is a growing recognition that the workforce is aging overall. And for a long time, we've known this, and you could go to human resources conferences and they talk about it, but they didn't do much about it. Right now, we're in an economy where we have this relatively tight labor market and management is out there looking for workers. So at least the 55 plus worker is getting a new look, a renewed look, a greater appreciation in this tight labor market. And I think that is slowly changing the way management thinks about workers.
You know, I don't know if this is something that you've heard in your research, but there is an attitude that I have heard from younger workers who share that same information, but with a much different interpretation, which is that as this, that you could look at an aging workforce and say, well, like, how is someone just starting their career supposed to ever get their footing in a situation where older work, there are a lot of older workers who are not leaving work?
So one of the things, this is one of the issues that are out there now, can be in a particular company, my story might necessarily work. But when you look at the economy, when workers 50 plus, 60 plus, 70 plus are doing well in the job market, younger workers are doing well in the job market. When you're 50 plus, 60 plus, 70 plus is not doing well in the job market, younger workers aren't. The fact of the matter is that the younger workers and older workers are, you know, they share an interest in a strong job market. The other thing is when you look at the research, you can always come up with these examples. When you look at the research, it's really compelling. What is it that workers want? They want to be valued members of a team. They want respect. They want opportunities for advancement. They want the ability to exercise their creativity. And this, it doesn't matter what generation you're looking at, whether you're looking at millennials, you're looking at Gen Xers, you're looking at boomers, it doesn't matter. Those values are shared throughout the company. Too many people are focusing on these sort of tensions. But actually, the fact of the matter is workers share a lot of the same values, and generation doesn't matter.
Let's talk to Tyler in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Tyler.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for taking my call. This is a terribly interesting conversation and something I think about often. I'm 33 years old, so my parents would be in the age group that's being discussed, the older, you know, not millennial generation, so to speak. So I was coming at this as a millennial. And I'm feeling, first of all, I would just agree with the last handful of statements that the author made about it's like a rising tide lifts all boats. Everyone benefits from a robust job market. And to me, that's an example of diversity, diversity of age, diversity of experience, employment backgrounds coming together. And I want to just give a quick anecdote and then ask a specific question. So my anecdote would be that I feel like I was the future as a young person. I was the future until I got to be about 30, at which point it was important for me to just kind of pipe down and listen to the experience in the room. That's my anecdote.
Being young is an asset, but you have to be like pretty young for that to really like maybe be seen as offsetting a relative lack of experience.
Exactly.
Okay.
So that's my anecdote. My specific question is how best can different generations in the workplace come together productively? I mean, that was suggested before the first commercial break. And I just maybe would ask for input on that or examples when it's worked well.
Okay, let's hear from Chris Farrell.
So there, I think it's organizations, managements, you know, deliberately when they're creating teams, when they're working in teams, that, you know, they make sure that it's multi-generational, that just as there are many expressions and words we no longer use when we're talking about young people, you know, to avoid a lot of the disparaging stereotypes and remarks that can be made about older workers. And it's really, from the point of view of an organization, generations don't matter. It's about talent. It's about what he had to offer. It's about what's your hunger and bringing people together to solve the problems. I mean, when Bob was saying, you know, didn't really have the time to, you know, whether people are surprised or not, you know, I think that's the attitude that you want in organizations. You don't, in a sense, you're deliberate about age, diversity, and inclusiveness, but then at the same time, you just say, it's about what can you offer? What are you bringing to the table? And by the way, if you're an employee here, you got something to offer.
Jump in here.
Well, you know, one of the things that's really changed a lot is the fact that most of us are working from our homes. I was on a conference call the other day with my team. One was in LA, one was in London. I don't know their age. I don't know anything about the way that they look. So we're working together, solving problems. So for me, it doesn't run, you don't run into it as often, maybe in the new world. If I was working in a large building with everyone, that I would understand those things. But most of the time, we're on computers or on phones with one another.
You know, I mean, it's interesting, though. I do think like age can be sort of coded even in like subtle ways in email, like the font you choose, even in your signature, can kind of be a quote tell, I would say.
So writing in all caps is a giveaway?
Or sharing an email address with a spouse.
Oh.
But regardless, I mean, Chris Farrell, do you think that the technology as the means of communication has an equalizing force or no? I mean, there are all sorts of arguments to be made on either side of that, too.
I think it does. And I think what Bob is doing, I mean, where the real equalizing force is there are people like Bob who are serial entrepreneurs. I think I can call you that, Bob.
Right.
And, you know, what they like doing is starting companies. I mean, that's what they like doing. And it's not that they're sitting around and saying, well, yeah, 68 years old, you know, should I really be starting a company? It's like, no, this is what I like doing. I enjoy doing this. Is, you know, I have purpose. And I think we just need to embrace that and recognize that there's a lot of people out there that that's what they want to be doing. There's also this trend that I find fascinating, which is older adults going into business with their millennial children.
Which and seems like it would be that model you were talking about, too.
Exactly. And they both bring much to the table. Typically, the older adults bring some capital and they bring some experience, and the younger people with some technology and extra hustle. And in the end, they're going to inherit the business. So you're trying to create this durable enterprise. And this is a really exciting trend, but it also emphasizes something that I don't think we repeat enough, which is that basically the generations get along.
You know,
they really do.
Chris Farrell, before you go, I want to share that when we were researching for this show, we spoke with some people at KC SourceLink, and they shared that the percentages here in Kansas City are not dramatically different from what you've shared nationally, but they are a little bit different. And so you've cited the nationally people between 55 and 65, that the percentage of the new entrepreneurial businesses, they make up, it's 25.5%. Here in Kansas City, it's 17%. But I'm curious about whether discrepancies from one region to another or one city to another, like what's significant about that?
So one of the things that I would make significant, and I don't know, so this is just a reaction to your question. I think one of the things in every metropolitan area in the country, there is an entrepreneurial ecosystem of co-sharing workspaces, incubators, accelerators. And does this ecosystem, is it welcoming to the 55 plus entrepreneur? Is it saying, come on in? Because most of the advertising and most of the marketing is talking about younger people, and that's great. But again, and it's also talking about more diverse audiences, but that ecosystem really matters.
Well, Chris Farrell, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And Bob Etzel, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Gina.
I'm Gina Kaufman. When Central Standard returns, we will meet the Wall Street Journal theater critic who hails from Missouri. That story is next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm sitting here with Terry Teachout. If you happen to read the Wall Street Journal, that name probably sounds familiar. He writes the sightings column, and he also writes about plays, movies, museums. It is not a shabby gig, in my humble opinion.
It's the best job I know.
That was going to be my first question. Well, what you don't see in the byline is that the guy writing the column is from the boot heel of Missouri.
I am.
He went to college at William Jewell, and he cut his teeth writing music reviews for the Kansas City Star. We're going to hear that story now. Terry Teachout, good morning.
It's nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
And you look exactly like your illustration in that little square.
Well, I certainly hope so. It was taken in a radio studio.
So your job is as sweet as it sounds.
It is. I mean, there are nights when you're sitting on the aisle thinking, why am I here? Will this ever end? But then there are other nights when you're there and what you're seeing is Hamilton. And as far as I know, there's no downside to that.
What are some of the best plays you've gotten to see in New York specifically during your time doing this? And then we'll branch out.
Well, somebody asked me that, and I'll hook it up with Out of Town because they're related. The best show I have ever seen or reviewed anywhere in my life was David Cromer's off-Broadway production of Our Town, which is one of the two great American plays. And Cromer is really the only American director whom I would not hesitate to call a genius. And this was a truly, profoundly revelatory production. And it happens, that was 10 years ago, and I think 3 weeks before that, I was here in Kansas City because Kansas City Rep was doing David's production of The Glass Menagerie, which was maybe the second best thing I've ever seen anywhere in my life. Those two plays are very near and dear to my heart. In fact, I just wrote a play myself about Tennessee Williams in the making of The Glass Menagerie.
And, a play within a play.
It was a play. It's a play about Williams and William Inge, who were, they met right around the time that The Glass Menagerie had its Chicago tryout. But I came, by this time, I knew who David Cromer was. He started his career in Chicago, and I review theater all over the United States. And I came out to Kansas City because it's Kansas City. It's part, one of my homes, but I really wanted to see what he did with this very great play, and it was so great that it just, you know, scorched my eyes. And then 3 weeks later, I come to New York, and he's doing Our Town, and it's just as good. So that probably is the best reviewing month I ever had in my life.
What year was this?
It was exactly 10 years ago.
Wow. 2009,
February 2009.
You know, your column sometimes does share bits and pieces of your own personal history. I was just reading your piece about The Green Book, where you get into some of the really important criticisms of that movie.
Yes.
But as part of that, you sort of casually mention that you saw one of the people in the story in real life perform on stage in Missouri.
In my hometown, Sykeston, 50 years ago. Don Shirley, who is the one of the two principal characters in the movie, he's the black pianist who does the tour of the Deep South, and the bouncer from the Copacabana is his chauffeur, and they become close friends. But Shirley, this was in 1969. The action in The Green Book took place, I think, 6 years before that. But Sykeston, where I come from, in the Boot Heel, is a town that its culture was like the Deep South. I am old, and I'm 63. I am just old enough to remember separate entrances. And it happens that Don Shirley was the first black musician I ever saw in person on the stage of my junior high school gymnasium in Sykeston, Missouri in 1969. So I had this incredibly very specific memory of him. And suddenly they're making a movie about this guy whom I really haven't thought of for a number of years because he died in semi-obscurity, which he shouldn't have. And the movie has now led to a revival of interest in his music, which is quite well deserved.
Tell me more about the Sykeston you grew up in and how you think it shaped you.
Well, it is a small town. It's not a tiny town. It's not a county seat or anything like that. It's the town where the people from all the really small towns come to do their shopping. And back then, you know, I was born in 1956, and the world was quite different then. You had three television networks, the CBS, ABC, and NBC, but they all had high culture programming as a routine part of their primetime activities. I watched the Ed Sullivan Show every Sunday night and saw, you know, Edward Fellella dancing ballet 1 week and the Beatles the next week. And this was all accessible to you. And as a result, network television was really my window on the larger world of culture. We had a community concert series. They were the ones who brought Don Shirley to town. My high school not only had a band and choirs, but it had an orchestra. I played violin in it. So to be in a small town like Sykeston in the 60s was a very different thing then. You were in a small town. I was 3 hours from any large city. I didn't see a major museum until I was in college. But I had access to that larger world, and that was what opened the door and made me think, this art thing, maybe this is something I might want to do and be.
You wrote a memoir in the 90s called City Limits about your journey from Missouri to New York. And I get the sense that you wrote it in part to make sense for yourself of how you started where you did and ended up where you are. Is that fair?
Yes. I think this is why most people write autobiographies. They're trying to sort out their lives, and they may also feel that they have something to say to other people about the meaning of those lives. Louis Armstrong, about whom I wrote a biography and then a play, wrote his autobiography, Satchmo, My Life in New Orleans, because he thought that his life had a larger meaning and that it might help people know how to live. And in my case, I wrote this book because I was trying to figure out what happened. How did I get from there to here? It's a long way from a town like Sykeston to the Upper West Side of New York.
What did you figure out? I mean, do you have a sense of like what the crucial pivotal moments were that led you from there to here?
Well, I would say it was the larger arc. It was the decision to pursue the life of art, which is what I'm in town for. I'm giving a lecture at William Jewell, my alma mater, tonight. They asked me to talk about what my work had taught me about life and vice versa. And I'm giving a lecture about what it means to commit yourself to the life of art and how it changes your life. And in my case, it was a very unusual thing for a small town boy to end up becoming what I became and doing what I did. And it was because I realized fairly early on that I wanted to be immersed in art. I wanted this to be what I did all day. You spend at least a third of your life working and another third of it sleeping. And you really ought to try to do something for a living that doesn't bore you. And art doesn't bore me.
It seems like your time in college at William Jewell was pretty pivotal. You were there, you switched majors from psychology to a self-created major?
Yeah, well, psychology came later. I started out as a music major. And then Wesley Forbes, who was then the chairman of the music department, said to me one day, you know, you like music, you play music, you also write. Have you ever thought that maybe what you ought to do is write about music? And this perfectly obvious thought had never occurred to me. So Dr. Forbes waved his magic wand, and suddenly I was doing an independent study with the man, John Haskins, who was then the music critic of the Kansas City Star. And that was in the spring. I went home over the summer, and he became ill, developed cancer. When I came back that fall, he was dying, and I saw him a couple more times. And before he died, he told his assistant, who succeeded him, about me. And as a result, as an undergraduate, I became the Kansas City Star's second-string classical music critic and their first-string jazz critic.
What was that like for you? I mean, can you tell us what being a guy that young in the position of going to classical music concerts, writing about them, and having that published in the newspaper, what was that like?
You know, when you're that young, you take the world for granted. I mean, you assume that what is happening to you is normal, that everything is normal. It's only later that you realize this is really something unusual that happened to me back then. And so, I mean, I was delighted. I remember the day my first piece came out. I got up, I don't know, at 7 in the morning, and I drove down to the little strip mall, and it had, we used to call them honor boxes, the ones where you put a quarter in and got the newspaper out. I put a quarter in and got 10 copies of the Kansas City Star out, so I owe the Kansas City Star $4.
So much for honor.
Yeah, so much for honor. And I wrote a biography of H.L. Mencken, who had a sort of similar experience. He said that seeing his words in print for the first time was like receiving an electrical jolt of a million volts while simultaneously drinking a barrel of brandy. And it was a little like that. You get used to that part, obviously. I mean, I've now been writing reviews for much more than half my life, but I will never forget what it felt to see my words in print for the first time.
So, I mean, this might actually be starting to sound like a much more linear story than we would start out thinking, because what led from there to here? Well, very early on, you were pursuing this thing. You were doing criticism very early in your education. But I am interested in, there is a period of your life where right out of school, you did flounder a bit.
Yes, I did. I couldn't make the transition to a full-time job. I had to pay the rent. I actually worked in an inner-city bank here in Kansas City as a teller. And it was very disorienting. It was very troubling. I just couldn't figure out how to get from point A to point E, I guess. And I decided to go back to school. This is where the psychology came in. I had had a very opportune experience with a psychotherapist when I was an undergraduate, and I thought maybe I should do that. And I went back to school for 2 years as a to get my undergraduate credits to become a therapist, to do graduate school. During that time, I worked on the graveyard shift of a suicide line, which is really one of the most illuminating things about human nature and character that you can ever experience. I still remember, as though they were on a tape, some of the calls that I got. And what I realized, I mean, I realized a lot of things. And for me personally, the most important thing I realized was that I was kidding myself, that I was really a writer, and that I was going to have to pursue that one way or another. And then I got lucky. I got an offer to be an intern at Harper's Magazine in New York. I went there. I was 29 years old, and it was like I had a key, and I finally found the right keyhole to put it in. I turned the key and walked into the rest of my life.
So if I've done the math right, you've actually lived away from Missouri longer than you lived in it. Does New York feel like your home now?
No. It felt like my home after 9/11. It happened on 9/11. I just finished a book and delivered it, and I went home to visit my mother. So I actually watched the news about 9/11 from the TV in the living room of the house where I grew up. And you will remember that every airplane in the United States was grounded that day, and I couldn't get back to New York. And I think for the first time in my life, I thought, my home is on fire. I have to get back.
I need to be there with my people.
And the first day that we were flying, I flew back and we did the approach to LaGuardia that loops around the southern end of the island. And I saw the smoke rising from ground zero. And at that time, and for a few years after that, I did feel that sense of home about New York. It's worn off, I think, because I am not in any way alienated from my childhood. I loved where I grew up. I loved Kansas City. I thought I would live here. And coming back here, you know, for a couple of days, I was just telling a friend of mine a few minutes ago, I feel like Emily in the last act of Our Town. I know where everything is, but when I talk, nobody can hear me. I reach out and I'm a ghost. But the city is still the same. And I think to myself, I love this place too.
What is it about New York that doesn't quite become home to you?
That's hard to say. Let me come at that in a different direction. The part of New York that seems like home to me is the people I love. New York is a city full of people who have come there for a reason. The New York
to be the best at something.
Yeah, the New Yorkiest people I know are all from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And you seek them out, the people who have the same obsessions that you do and who have the same interests that you do. And you start to think of your friends as a quasi-family. Everybody has this experience. And I have many close friends, and they are as important to me as they could possibly be. They're in New York, they're my home. In this town and in Sikeston, the place is my home.
Interesting. You know, how do you think that your roots here and your time in Kansas City have influenced the trajectory of the rest of your life?
Well, this is where I learned to write for openers. But I mean, it's where I first did a lot of things. I mean, this is where I, you know, first played in an orchestra, a real orchestra, you know, played at a jam session, talked on the radio, saw my words in print and got paid for it. I saw my words in print in high school, but nobody gave me any money for it. It's different when you actually get money.
And the person reading it is not obligated.
Correct. Exactly right. And this is the city where I learned what I was and what I had to do and be. And there are all sorts of things I like about Kansas City besides that. This is a city that has the right proportions.
What do you mean?
It's not too big. It's not too small. It has all the things that you want in it. It has a very serious and active art scene. It has one of the greatest museums in America, which I didn't realize when I lived here because I hadn't started looking at paintings. I collect them now, but back then, I think I went to the Nelson Atkins once when I lived in Kansas City. How ridiculous that is.
And now you consider it one of the best.
Well, there's everybody does. I mean, it's the Nelson Atkins now has, because of the new building, the Nelson Atkins now has the world reputation that it should have had 20 years ago. Because of the quality of the collection.
And this brings me to a question about the content of what you do. I mean, you've been doing this long enough that I'm sure you've witnessed all kinds of change in the arts itself and then also in arts criticism. What are some of the important things you've noticed?
Well, the change in the arts, I would say, this is especially true of theater, is that American regional theater has, the word I like to use is, it's become deprovincialized. I'm the only drama critic working for a national publication who travels regularly all over the country. And I learned very quickly that there was theater of the highest quality everywhere in the United States. When I started reviewing out-of-town theater, you know, I thought it was praise to say, oh, this production's good enough for Broadway. Well, the truth is, you know, I see Broadway productions that are good enough for Chicago. And as I just said to you a few minutes ago, I mean, one of the two greatest shows I ever saw was here in Kansas City. So my whole perspective about that has changed because I now know that theater is an activity that people do on the highest level of seriousness and attainment throughout the country. It's not like it was 50 years ago when most of the serious theater in a town the size of Kansas City would be touring companies. No, it happens here. It's made here. And
it's interesting that you've come to that realization from your post doing theater criticism.
Well, there's no other way you could know it. It's a big country. And, you know, it's not like Time magazine is going out and reporting on theater in Chicago. It's because the Wall Street Journal decided it wanted me to cover theater all over the United States that I made this life-changing discovery. That's one side of the coin. The other side is that, as everybody knows, the traditional business model for newspapers has disintegrated. And all newspapers are cutting back. And the first thing they cut is arts coverage. I'm very lucky in that I write for a national newspaper and thus am able to be a drama critic and write every Friday.
And from a city with an identity so steeped in in that practice.
Exactly right. So, I mean, I can sleep at night because I work for the Wall Street Journal, but I've seen it happen in newspapers all over the country, and it is a terrible thing for the arts. Virgil Thompson, another Kansas City boy, said very famously that whether you liked criticism or not, you had to remember that it was the only antidote that artists have to paid publicity. You discover that when suddenly you don't have a theater critic in Council Bluffs, Iowa anymore. And I think that a lot of people who, not without reason, think they hate critics, they're going to discover what it's like in a world that doesn't have them and also doesn't have arts coverage in newspapers. This will change as new business models for newspapers or successor organizations to newspapers emerge. But right now we're in a terrible state of turmoil. So those are the two things that are happening. Regional art's getting better. Regional coverage of art is getting worse simultaneously.
So we've established that you are very lucky to have a job and a secure one as a drama critic.
Boy, but howdy, yes.
How do you balance enjoying the arts with writing about them? Because it is always a danger making something you love into your job.
Yes, it is. But I think specifically in theater, I didn't become a working drama critic until my late 40s. Most people come to it younger. And I think because of that, I never got jaded. I'm the least blasé person you're ever going to meet in this world. And I still get excited every time I come into a theater, wherever it is, and sit down on the aisle. And the lights go down, and I feel that sense of expectancy. It doesn't always last. You know, sometimes, usually it takes about 15 minutes to know what you're seeing. And when the clock hits that moment, you know it's going to be bad or it's going to be good. But if it's going to be good, I'm so excited.
And have you ever had a surprise turn or a comeback after that 15-minute mark?
A couple of times. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does, you know you're still paying attention.
Well, that's good.
Yes.
Well, Terry Teachout, drama critic for the Wall Street Journal, thank you so much for being here.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Terry is in town for an alumni achievement dinner at his alma mater, William Jewell, and our time is up. You can grab the audio from either of today's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. You can also always sign up to have all of our shows sent to you on your phone, kind of like a podcast. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. It's where you can do both of those things. Hear today's show and sign up to hear all of our shows. Tomorrow is our first Friday Arts show for March. We'll hear from jazz musician Herman Mahari, who's here for the KU Jazz Festival. And we've invited Kevin Willmott to give the Oscar acceptance speech you didn't hear on Sunday when he won the award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Don't miss it. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next. Stick around.